Good. The wheel. It is a wonderful device. It is so helpful to us. We use it every day. Why is it that you do not have to invent the wheel? Why? Because it's already been invented. This morning, probably all of us either drove an automobile to church or we rode in one. And probably not a person here made the automobile that brought you to church. Why? There are other people, car manufacturers, that made those automobiles for us. Those car manufacturers are more experienced, more skillful at making cars than we are. They save us a lot of trouble. My point is that we should all stand on the shoulders of other people and learn from them what has taken them years, decades to find out. But what happens when we don't stand on the shoulders of others? We either learn the slow, hard way, making unnecessary mistakes, or worse, we never do learn. The point here that I'm making is this. Most of us can benefit from the steady hand and wise voice of an older, wiser person who is further down the path of life to which we are now headed. Now, you may recognize this name. The late Reggie White was a very famous football player for the Green Bay Packers. And if he's not already there, he'll end up someday in the Hall of Fame. Did you know that Reggie White was an ordained Baptist preacher? And one day I was reading an article he wrote in a national Christian magazine. And he said, the only regret I have after becoming a Christian was I fell into immorality. And he said, now I'm not excusing myself, but I had no mentor. If I would only had a mentor who would have instructed me in this area, held me accountable, prayed for me, maybe I wouldn't have fallen into sexual immorality. He's right about that. Having a mentor is no guarantee he would not have fallen in it, but it would have greatly reduced the risk. Now, some years ago, this is not their real name, there was this couple at Moody, I'll call Jack and Jill, and Jack was struggling intensely with pornography. He asked for my help. And so I would give Jack some time periodically to help him get over this vice, and he continued to struggle with it. He asked me for more time, more help, and because I was so busy at Moody, I did not give him the additional help that he asked for. Then he started dating Jill. Here was a young woman who came to Moody, never been kissed, never been touched by a man. At first, they had a healthy, wholesome relationship. But remember what he was struggling with? Porn, sexual lust. That just breeds an unhealthy relationship. And their relationship morally began to decline and degenerate. They engaged in immorality, and the Institute dismissed both of them. I think part of the failure in their relationship can be placed at my doorstep. I regret this. And I've often thought if I had only given Jack the additional time he was asking for, maybe this couple would have maintained a pure, wholesome, healthy relationship pleasing to God. Well, I've not always made mistakes with students. I have done some things correctly. About 5-7 years ago, I was talking to Dustin the day before he graduated from Moody. And he said, my fiance, Natalie, and I have done everything right in our relationship. And I asked him, what do you mean by that? And he said, just what I said. As boyfriend and girlfriend, we haven't made any mistakes. We've done everything correctly. For example, in expressing our affection physically for one another, not once have we gone too far. Not once have we exceeded proper boundaries. And when he said that, I became green with envy. As good a courtship as Sweet Sue and I had, we can't say that we did everything correctly. So I said, Dustin, how did you guys do that? How'd you do everything right? And he said, don't you know? And I asked, no what? Then he reminded me, a year and a half ago, I came to your office saying, Dr. Sauer, I've got a girlfriend. As a man, I'm concerned that I lead the relationship correctly. Help me do that. Do you have any advice? For 1 hour, you gave me suggestions that you said came from things you did wrong and things you did right. I made careful notes. And after my meeting with you, I went to my girlfriend and I said, I've been offered these suggestions. I'd like to incorporate them in our relationship. Will you help me? She said, not so fast. Let's discuss these suggestions. So we went through the list and discussed your suggestions one by one. And at the end, she said, yeah, I like these suggestions. I'll help you to incorporate them. We followed the advice that you gave me in an hour. And as a result, we've done everything correctly. Now, I don't know that I've said this from the pulpit. I think I've said this from the Sunday school class. If I could go back to college when I met Sue, or as soon as we got married, if I knew back then what I know now, would we have done things differently? When Sue and I started dating, all I knew was a guy and a girl who are interested in each other, start spending time together, they go out on dates. That is to say, you jump off in deep water, you thrash around and learn how to swim romantically. Most couples who do it that way drown. If I knew back then what I know now, Sue and I, as soon as we started dating, we would have found an older couple who had the two things we want. Healthy relationship with Christ, good marriage. They are years, decades down the path that she and I, romance, have just now started out on. They've already made their mistakes. That older couple have it together. They know what works and what doesn't work. They could have taken me and Sue by the hand and sped up our learning curve and eliminated a lot of the mistakes that we made. Now, the person that today that I know that's the closest to being like the Apostle Paul is this man right here. How many of you know who John Perkins is? Let me see your hand. Anybody? He is an old black man from Mississippi who has, I think, a sixth grade education. But he's like the Apostle Paul. Moody Bible Institute is so impressed with him that a few years ago we had him up to Chicago as the commencement speaker at our annual graduation ceremony. And after the ceremony, I couldn't believe it. Here's John Perkins. I heard so much about this guy. I went up and introduced myself to him. And as we were talking, John Perkins has an incredible inner city ministry in Jackson, Mississippi, where I'm from. And that summer, I visited him down in Jackson. And while I was there, there were teams of students from many colleges, universities, and seminaries all over America that were spending the summer down there so John Perkins could teach them how to do inner city ministry. And as I was talking to John Perkins, he said, after I became a Christian as a young man, an old white man in my church got a hold of me and taught me how to love my wife and be a gentleman, treat her right. He taught me how to walk with God, how to overcome sin and temptation, how to witness to people, how to deal with adversity. I never had the opportunity of going to a place like Moody. That old man mentoring me made all the difference in the world. That old man mentoring me was my Moody Bible Institute. A mentor is an older, wiser person in a discipling relationship with a younger, less mature, but teachable individual. Or maybe, not an individual, but a group, a small group of people. And what is mentoring, since that's what we're talking about? Let's define it. Mentoring is progressively transferring the knowledge acquired and skills cultivated by a more mature person to a receptive individual, thus leaving a permanent and beneficial imprint on him or on her. Now, God has given each of you and me a fund of knowledge and experience. You have a God-given fund of knowledge and experience that is not just for you. God means to use your fund of knowledge and experience, not only for yourself, but to benefit other people. You can be a blessing and help to other people. I don't want you to sell yourself short and think pastors, missionaries, Bible teachers, they can help other people. No, you can't. Actually, it's God working through you to help and bless other people. So this morning, we want to consider mentoring and discipleship, and well, we should. What did Jesus say in the Great Commission that we looked at last week? Go and make converts. No, he didn't say make converts. Go and make disciples. How? By baptizing them. That is, leading them to Christ, helping them become Christians, and by teaching them to obey all that I command you. The church is to be about the business of making disciples. training men and women to be followers of Jesus Christ. That is what God is up to today in and through the local church. So please find this insert in your handout. And I want us to look quickly at some key verses in the Bible that deal with this issue of mentoring and discipling. Over the top, I've have it entitled, As Iron Sharpens Iron, that comes from Proverbs 27:17. And let's begin with the first verse at the top, Proverbs 12:27, that gives us a word of caution. Let the righteous carefully examine his neighbor. Now, the neighbor is a potential friend, potential Christian, potential disciple. And what that's saying is, before you let somebody get close to you, do this. Hold them at an arm's length and examine them. Is this person that I'm thinking about spending time with a Christian or non-Christian? Moral or immoral person? Open or not? Respect authority? Rebellious or what? Why be so cautious? Look at how this verse ends. For the way of the wicked can lead the righteous astray. Now, I don't know if I've mentioned this, but when my son Joseph was in college, he asked a high school girl to go to the coffee shop with him. And he said, Tracy, your brother is my best friend. So I know real well the crowd you run with. And Tracy, I'm telling you, you are running with the wrong crowd. And if you don't stop, they're going to have a bad influence in you. In this ear, out the other ear. 2 years later, Joseph showed me the letter that Tracy sent him. And it said, in it, she said, Joseph, you remember taking me out to the coffee shop a couple years ago and warning me that I was running the wrong crowd and you urged me to break off? You were right. I disregarded what you said. That crowd has inflicted scars and wounds on me that I am going to suffer with remorse over the rest of my life. Now, for emphasis, the next verse, 1 Corinthians 15:33, says the same thing. Do not be deceived. Bad company does indeed corrupt good morals. Folks, this is a matter of lie down with dogs and we're going to get up with fleas. The people we spend time with are going to have an impact on us. And that influence is not going to be neutral. It's going to be good or bad. Now, some years ago, after my class at Moody finished, the lecture was over, students were filing out the door, except one girl. And when everybody was out the door, she approached me and said, can we talk? And then she burst into tears. And I said, what's the problem? And she said, I'm an American, but I grew up in France where my parents are missionaries, and my older sister grew up there as well. My older sister married a wonderful, godly Frenchman who's the pastor of a Christian church. Not long ago, my sister had to temporarily leave the city in France where she and her husband lived and go to another city to take a 3-month course at a French university that her educational program required her to take. In the class was a single Frenchman who said, could we have coffee together? And she said, no, I'm a married woman. I don't associate with single men. He said, okay, but we're classmates. Can we get together and study just as classmates? She imprudently started meeting with this fellow alone, studying. That led to having coffee with him. That led to having dinner with him. She eventually left her pastor husband and moved in and started living with this single, non-Christian Frenchman. We are not talking about a high school girl that did that. A woman. A Christian woman, a pastor's wife. Look at that verse again. Don't be deceived. I want you to know the Greek could be translated, don't fool yourself. Bad company can corrupt you and me. So Scripture is warning, there are certain people we must not hang with. And then the Bible is going to speak positively. There are other people that we should spend time with because they can be an immense benefit to us. Now, according to Genesis 21, some relationships must greatly be altered or severed altogether. Now, here are the principal individuals in this passage. Let's remember this. Abraham was a husband, married to Sarah. However, Sarah was incapable of having children. And so Sarah gave her mistress, her maid, Hagar, to Abraham, and said, I can't give you any children, but Hagar, maybe she can. And so Abraham And Hagar had an illegitimate child named Ishmael, and Isaac eventually was born to Sarah and Abraham. Okay, those are the people that Genesis 21 is talking about. Now look at verse 9. Genesis 21 and verse 9. Sarah saw Hagar's son, whom she had born to Abraham, mocking. He was mocking her son Isaac. Verse 10. So she said to Abraham, drive out this maid and her son. And the matter distressed Abraham greatly because of his son. He loved Ishmael. But God said to Abraham, do not be distressed because of the lad and your maid. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her. Now what's God saying here? There, Abraham, you've got to take Hagar and your child through her, Ishmael, and send them away. Sever the umbilical cord. End that relationship permanently. Absolutely. Don't worry about Hagar and Ishmael. I will take care of them. I will provide for them. Go ahead and feel bad that you've got to end the relationship. Don't feel unduly bad. It's bad you have to end it. It will be badder, and I'm deliberately using bad English. It will be badder, worse, if you don't end the relationship. Now, Chelsea, from a northern suburb in Chicago, as a high school girl, was a serious Christian. Her best friend was an atheist. And Chelsea began to have a heavy heart about spending so much time with this atheistic classmate, a girl. And Chelsea told her atheistic friend, your words of profanity have recently been coming out of my mouth. The disrespect that you show the teachers at school, I'm beginning to show. The old disobedience that I see you give to your parents, I'm now showing that same disobedience to my parents. God has laid it on my heart to end my relationship with you. And the atheist said, do you mean to tell me that you're going to put God over me? Does God mean that much to you? And Chelsea said, yes. And the girl said, maybe I should reconsider God. Chelsea ended the relationship with that atheistic girl, led that atheist to become a Christian. Probably every person here has already in the past had to greatly change some relationship or end a relationship altogether that was bad for us, that was detrimental to us. Abraham had to do it. Now, according to Proverbs 13:20, the next passage, we can influence teachable folks. But if we don't guard our heart, others can have a negative influence on us. Proverbs 13:20. He who walks with wise people will be wise. Now, 26-year-old Jeremy from Kentucky brought his 21-year-old girlfriend, Hannah from Colorado, to me and Sue. I remember the first words out of their mouth. You two have been married longer than we've been alive. Surely you know something about dating, courtship, marriage that we don't know. Why should we figure it all out for ourselves? Why should we start from scratch? Could we meet with you two on a regular basis and you all talk to us about man, woman relationships, dating, romance, marriage? Observe our relationship. If you see something you don't like, tell us. If you have to, rebuke us. But just teach us about this. We met with them for a year. It was so good to know when they married. Here's another couple that did everything right. Folks, it can be done. But we have a better chance, for example, in romance of doing things right if we have the help of an older couple further down the life path of life that already made their mistakes. Don't invent the wheel. Don't figure everything out for yourself. But look at how this verse ends. But the companion of fools will, not maybe, will suffer harm. Now note the important verses in the next passage. 1 Thessalonians 4, 1, 4 through 7. We are convinced, brethren, beloved by God, that He, God, chose you. What does He mean by that? As much as one human being can be about another, we're certain that you Thessalonians are genuinely saved. Now, why does Paul think that God has chosen them? Well, he's going to give two reasons. In verse 5 is a subjective reason, and then in verse 6 is an objective reason. The subjective reason is the quality of Paul's ministry. Look at what he says in verse 5. We're convinced that God chose you. Why do we think that? For our gospel did not come to you in word only. He's not minimizing human speech. It's a necessary means of communication. But what he's saying is our ministry to you folks in Thessalonica didn't consist just in talk, but also in power and in the Holy Spirit. God enabled us, empowered us, and through us, the Holy Spirit worked in your life. And with full conviction, we sincerely believe the gospel we preached to you was the truth of God. A friend of mine has a friend who's a Methodist pastor. My friend visited that pastor church on Easter. And he preached on the resurrection of Jesus. And my friend said to his friend, the Methodist pastor, "Oh, I didn't know you believed in the resurrection of Jesus." And the pastor said, "I don't." And my friend said, "Well, why were you preaching about it?" "Because the people in the congregation believe in it. They think Jesus raised from the dead. I don't." Now, Paul is saying here, that wasn't me. When I came to Thessalonica, I really believed the gospel that I preached to you was from heaven. It was true. And then he says, "Just as you know what kind of men we proved to be among you." How would the Thessalonians, I'm asking you, how would the Thessalonians know what kind of man Paul was? Because he was willing to spend time with them outside, away from the pulpit, outside of church. He let them get close to him. And they could see he was a man of integrity who really lived out the truth that he preached. And notice how verse 5 ends. "You know what kind of men we proved to be among you for your sake." Why did we live such pure, obedient lives? It was so God could work through us for your sake, for your benefit. So that's the subject of reason in verse 5, why Paul's sure the Thessalonians were saved. And in verse 6, we had the objective reason. And that is the Thessalonians' change of character and conduct. Look at verse 6. "You also became imitators of us and imitators of the Lord, having received the word in much tribulation with joy of the Holy Spirit, so that you became an example to all the believers in Macedonia and in Achaia." When you give the gospel to a worldly, unsaved person, and after giving the gospel, that person begins to change his character and conduct, and he starts acting like you. He becomes an imitator of Christ. What conclusion do you reach? The gospel you gave to him, he's received, it's taken root, and it's changing him. What's Paul saying? One reason I'm so sure you Thessalonians are saved is because you had a vast change of character and conduct. You started imitating Jesus. You turned from idols and started serving God. One of my students at Moody is Steve. And Steve and I would meet regularly, almost every week, for mentoring and discipleship. And in the church he works in Chicago, the church gave him high school boys to teach. And he said, "Doc Sauer, we're meeting every Wednesday night, and I want you to come over to our church, and I want you to just sit in the group of the high school boys that I'm discipling." It was wonderful. Here were 12 high school fellas. And Steve just opened up the scriptures and taught them a lesson, led them in prayer. And then he threw the time open to deal with any issues, struggles, and problems they were going through. It was wonderful to see that what I was pouring into Steve, he was taking and pouring into these 12 high school students. Now, there's a price that we must pay to mentor and spend time with other people. Look at 1 Thessalonians 2, 7 and 8. "We prove to be gentle among you, as a nursing mother tenderly cares for our own children." What is a mother like who has a newborn baby nursing at her breast? That mother is the epitome of gentleness. I told the Sunday school class this morning that some years ago, I was the interim pastor of a church up in Milwaukee, and my first day on the job, the elders told me, our pastor who just left was an in-your-face pastor. He did not hesitate to chew you out and really get after you. We can't tell you how many individuals and families he drove away from this church. What's Paul saying here? That's not the way I was. I was gentle in your midst, as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children. "Having thus a fond affection for you, we remain determined to impart to you two things. Not only the gospel of God," that's the easy thing. We were determined to give you, Thessalonians, two things. The truth, that's the easy part. "And our own lives." Now, what does he mean by that, our own lives? Our time, our listening ears, our helpful advice, our prayers, our shared experiences. What's Paul saying? I was willing to spend time with you folks outside the pulpit, away from church. I was willing, if you wanted me to get involved in your life and help you out. Now, I told the Sunday school class this last Sunday, that when I was a seminary student, I heard about a famous pastor of the Wheaton Bible Church, located about 40 miles from here, Wheaton Bible Church. And well, later, when I taught at Moody, we attended the Wheaton Bible Church. Now, that famous pastor of national reputation was no longer there. I knew an old man at the Wheaton Bible Church. And I said, when I was a seminary student, I heard about one of your former pastors, Reverend John Doe, who had a national reputation. Would you have happened to have been a member of this church? When that man was a pastor, he said, yeah, I was a member. What was he like? And the old man said, I have to answer that question in two ways. As a preacher, he had no equal. That's why he was so famous all over America. He was unusually skilled at opening up the Bible and preaching and explaining it to you. But as a pastor, he did not know your name and he did not want to know your name. He would not give you the time of day outside the pulpit. The only thing he was interested in was preparing a sermon, coming to the pulpit and preaching it. And when that was over, retreating and hiding in his study to prepare next Sunday's sermon. He was a preacher, not a pastor. He was an expositor, not a shepherd. What's Paul saying? That's not me. I gave you the truth. That was the easy part. I gave you my life. I was willing to spend time with you. We in this church need to be willing to spend time with people who may be younger, less experienced, less mature. They're a little bit further back on the path of the Christian life than we are. There's a price to pay in spending time with people. Again, remember, you have that fund of experience. What does 1 Peter 2 say? By Jesus' wounds, the cross, the crucifixion, we've been healed. Now, you've heard me say this before. In a similar but lesser manner, others can be healed by our wounds. If we are transparent enough to share some of our past mistakes, hurts, and painful experiences with them. And that's what Paul is saying here, that he was willing to do that. Now, look on the back of your sheet at 1 Thessalonians 2, 10 through 12. Note the personal aspects of Paul's ministry in 1 Thessalonians 2. Verse 10, you are witnesses. You didn't just hear about my ministry, you observed it. You are witnesses, and so is God, how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behave toward you. Now, the word devoutly concerns a person's relationship with God. You saw my relationship with the Lord. The word uprightly concerns a person's relationship with others. You saw how I dealt with, treated other people in the church, both and people outside the church. And you saw how blamelessly I conducted myself. That concerns his relationship with himself. He didn't taint himself. He didn't feed from the trough of the world. You are witnesses, and so was God, how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behave toward you believers. And verse 11 appeals to their knowledge. Just as you know how we were exhorting and encouraging and imploring each one of you as a father would his own children. Now look at the word you. That refers to the whole congregation of the Thessalonian church. He ministered to the whole congregation at once. But look at the expression, each one of you. That's singular. It refers to every individual in the church. Folks, what I'm saying is this. A pastor should, yes, minister to the whole congregation. But not just that. He should be willing to get involved with every individual in the congregation that wants some time, wants some help with him. And notice the way Paul puts it. You know how we were exhorting, encouraging, and imploring each one of you. The word exhorting refers to a person's intellect. You're urging that person to embrace the gospel, embrace the truth. The word encouraging refers to a person's emotions. Some people are just weak and faint-hearted, and we need to encourage them and hold them up and help them stand. The word imploring refers to a person's will. Here's somebody who's deliberately doing wrong, and now you admonish them to stop doing wrong and start doing right. So we were exhorting, encouraging, and imploring each one of you as a father would his own children. I'm not going to go into all the details on this like I did this morning in Sunday school. At church, one of my lady students is Jessica. She came to my office and said, here's an issue in my life. I'd like your advice. And I said, Jessica, if you were my daughter and I were your father, here is the advice I would give you. I tried to picture myself as her dad, loving her and wanting to give her the best possible advice I could give her. And that's what Paul is saying. I had the affection for each of you as a father does for his children. And I dealt with you lovingly as a father. Why? Verse 12, so that you would walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. Now, some years ago, I was teaching a Friday night Bible class at a downtown Chicago church. Had about 60 people in the class. Very few of them were in their 20s. Most of those people were in their 30s and 40s. And right over here, I allowed the 60 students to ask questions during the hour of Bible study. The hardest questions were asked by a young girl right over here. I had a difficulty answering her hard questions. And after the Bible study was over, the people were standing around talking before they left. This young girl approached me and said, I want to ask you another question. Well, as she's asking, I'm peering into her face and I'm thinking to myself, this college student, that's what I thought she was, looks so young. So after I answered her question, I said, I have a question for you. How old are you? She said, 14. 14? The hardest questions weren't asked by the 20, 30, and 40 years old. They were asked by a 14-year-old girl. And as we were talking, she said this, my intimacy with Christ is not what it once was. I am very attracted to sin. I am very taken with the world. And I sensed that she was on spiritual thin ice. And I said, if you ever have a day off from school, why don't you consider coming up to Moody Bible Institute and spending the day with me? She said, as a matter of fact, I have this Friday. How about that? I said, okay, give me the phone number of your parents. Let me call them, introduce myself, and see if I can get your parents' advice to let their 14-year-old daughter come spend a day with a man they never met. Well, to my surprise, her parents said, oh, sure. Jenny wants to come up and spend the day with you? Let her come up. So I had Jenny meet me that Friday at Moody at 7 o'clock. Jenny was her name. But I also had Misty, one of our senior girls, meet us in the Moody cafeteria for breakfast at 7 a.m. I introduced Misty and Jenny to one another. They hit it off. For the rest of that year, Jenny would come up to Moody and spend an hour with Misty every day. And the day they met, Misty took Jenny off my hands, took her to her classes, to chapel, to lunch, took her to her dorm, introduced her to girlfriends on her floor. Misty was just what that young 14-year-old girl needed. And then when Misty graduated, she takes Jenny and hands her off to Andrea. And in Andrea's last 2 years at Moody, Jenny would come up and spend an hour each week with Andrea. What did Misty and Andrea do? They took a younger girl and they poured into her life. Look at Philippians 3:17. Brethren, join in following my example. Now, I'm not always in Philippi. So, observe those who walk according to the pattern you have in us. Now, while at Moody, several girls have asked me to disciple them. I've had several girls say, Dr. Sauer, would you mentor me? Would you disciple me? I'm just as concerned for our lady students as I am our male students. But I think there's a better way to do it. And what would that be? Look at Titus 2. Older women, likewise, are to be reverent in their behavior, not malicious gossips, nor enslaved to much wine, teaching what is good, that they may train the younger women to love their husbands, love their children, to be pure, to be sensible, pure, workers at home, etc., etc. The best teacher of women is women. And so, my wife, Sweet Sue, is a part-time teacher's aide. She has every Monday off. And I've said, Sue, I want that day. I want you to give me every Monday. Would you please come down to Moody and make yourself available to meet with Moody girls, these young college girls, who are looking for the input of an older woman in their life. So Sue starts meeting with girls at Moody at 6 a.m. and finishes at 7 p.m. every Monday. Outside my office on the bulletin board is a sign-up sheet. It's called the Sweet Sue sign-up sheet. And she'll start meeting with girls at 6, 7, 8, and gives them a one-hour increment from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. Now, what's that? 13 straight hours. Well, one day, Emily missed a quiz. She came into my office to get the quiz. As I'm looking for the quiz to give Emily, Sarah sticks her head in my office and says, Dr. Sauer, you don't know me. I'm not in any of your classes. But I've heard that your wife comes down to Moody and mentors Moody girls. I just want to know, would Sue mentor me? And I said, well, I can't answer that question for Sue, but if you'll show up at my office today at 2 o'clock, I'll introduce you to Sue. The two of you can talk, and the two of you can make that decision. And Sarah said, well, there's something else. My best friend here at Moody is Joyce. She's looking for an older woman to mentor her. Do you think that Sue would mentor Joyce? And I said, well, I can't speak for Sue, but if you'll have Joyce show up at my office at 3 o'clock, I'll introduce the two of them. They two of them can talk, and they can make that decision. Sarah leaves. Emily, who's in my office to get a quiz, says, I didn't know that. You mean your wife disciples Moody girls? For 2 months, I've been asking God to give me an older woman to mentor me. Do you think Sue would mentor me? Well, I can't answer that question for Sue, but if you'll be here at 4 o'clock, I'll introduce you to the two of them, and you two can talk, and you two can make that decision. I want you to know that Emily started meeting with Sue for her last 2 years at Moody. That girl does today what Sue did with her. She mentors young women. Now, yesterday afternoon, Saturday afternoon, yesterday, I had one of my Moody fellows come over to my house. We spent 2 hours together. He and I get together regularly for mentoring. I disciple him. He told me something very interesting yesterday. He said, my mother is a struggling Christian. Saturday morning, yesterday morning, Mom met for the first time with our pastor's wife. After that meeting, Mother came home, and I've never seen my mother like this. She had a face of peace and joy. She was refreshed by meeting with the pastor's wife. And I said, you need to encourage your mom to meet with the pastor's wife again. And tomorrow, when you go to church, I want you to find the pastor's wife and let her know the impact God had on your mother through her. The best teacher of women is women. Mark 3 informs us of an important part of Jesus' ministry. Jesus summoned those whom he himself wanted, and they came to him, and he appointed 12. Now notice this, that they might spend time with him. And that he might send them out to preach. So he let them spend time with them. He taught them how to walk with God, how to live life correctly, and then he prepared them to do Christian service, and he sent them out. Now, Simone was one of my students at Moody. And in a Chicago church, students at Moody are required to have a PCM, Practical Christian Ministry. And for her Practical Christian Ministry, she discipled high school girls in the church that she attended. And Simone told me, she said, I'm scared of these high school girls. I'm not much older than they are. I don't know much more than they do. And I said, Simone, it's true you're not much older, but you're a bit older. You don't know much more than those girls, but you know a little bit more. You're not that far down the path of life than they are, but you're a little bit further down the path of life. Don't you abandon those girls. They are just what you need. And if you're afraid of them, that's good. Let that fear drive you to God's feet and make you dependent upon God to work with you in dealing with them. Well, one Sunday I was invited to preach in a Chicago church. As soon as I walked in the church, the first thing that caught my mind, it was full of high school girls. I felt like I'd walked into a youth program. And I remember thinking, why so many high school girls? And in the middle of those high school girls was Simone. I put two and two together. This is the church Simone works in. These are the girls she mentors. When I got up to preach, the first three pews were packed with Simone's high school girls. And after the service, I was standing around listening to these girls talk, and I heard one girl say to Simone, Simone, when I'm in college, I need a car so I can do with high school girls what you do with us. And I said, what does Simone do with you high school girls? During the week, she comes over to our house, helps us with our homework, helps us maintain a good, respectful attitude with our parents, helps us maintain a pure relationship with our boyfriends. On church, on Sunday, she picks us up and brings us to church. I want to disciple high school girls when I'm in college like Simone does us. Like Jesus, according to 2 Timothy, Paul had his own disciples. Look at 2 Timothy 2:2. The things which you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, these entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. Now, Andy is going to be here next month. That is, in Chicago. He's from Florida. I'm hoping I can get him to come out here. I'd like to get him to come up here and give a testimony to you. Who is Andy? Blue collar worker, heavy equipment operator, digs holes in the ground with his heavy equipment. And I came in contact with him some years ago when he lived in Illinois. He called me up on the phone and said, I fear I'm losing my wife. I just about destroyed my marriage. We need help. So and I got in help. God wonderfully healed their marriage and turned it around. And then Andy said, would you have any time for me? So he and I started meeting each other every Thursday when we both got off work. And he said, teach me how to be a gentleman and love my wife. Then later he said, teach me how to study the Bible. Then later he said, teach me how to do Christian ministry and help people. I have such joy and satisfaction when I lend a helping hand to hurting needy people. And so what is Paul saying? The things which you've heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to do that. Teach other people as well. Now flee from youthful lust and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace with the help of those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. We all need help. And in our last passage, 2 Timothy 3, note the effects of discipleship. Paul's talking to Timothy. You adopted my teaching, the truth that I believe you embraced. My conduct, the way I live, you started living. You adopted my purpose. What my objectives are in life became your objectives. You adopted my faith. You saw me trust God. You trust God that way. My patience, my love, my perseverance. You, however, continue in the things which you've learned and become convinced of, knowing from whom you have learned them. Sue and I were approached by this couple struggling in their marriage, and they said, would you two show us how to get what we see in marriage you two have? We say that you have a happy marriage. How? We don't have it. Can you help us? So what are we seeing now about mentoring and discipleship? Teaching the younger person the truth with one's lips. Modeling the truth by living it out in the mentor's daily life and in practical issues. Thirdly, the mentor spends time with the younger person or maybe a group, small group, and some of this time is spent in listening to that person. When this young man came over to the house yesterday, I said, okay, where do you want to start? Oh, he was full of issues, problems. I needed to hear him talk so I'd know exactly where to scratch. So one of the things we do in discipling is let a person talk. Let's find out what's going on his or her life so we know what the issues are and we know where to lend a helping hand. Helping the younger person, mentoring is helping the younger person with his problems, struggles, questions, opportunities with various issues in his life. Do you realize, and I'm sure you do, that not all a person's issues can be addressed by a sermon from the pulpit? This may be good for the church as a whole. A sermon, but it's not scratching where you itch. You need somebody to sit down with you alone and in private and let you pour your heart out to that man or that woman so that person sees exactly what the issues are in your life. And mentoring is praying regularly for the younger person and assisting him, her, in his own ministry and service. So I want to know, do you need an older person in your life or are you trying to invent the wheel? Don't invent the wheel. It's already been done. Don't try and figure everything out about God, the Christian life, marriage, difficulty, trials by yourself. Latch on to an older person who is older, further down the path of life. Learn from that person what's taken that person decades to find out. That older person can take you by the hand and speed up your learning curve. And what does 2 Timothy say again? We need to pursue righteousness. Look at the last three lines. With the help of those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. I want you to consider being the older person in a younger person's life. Now you may think you're inadequate. You can't do that. God has given each of you a fund of knowledge and skill that I don't have. And it's not only for your benefit, it's for the benefit of other people that God can bring across your path. I want you to consider being the older person. Now, I want you to know about mentoring and discipling. It's like playing basketball. It's like playing the piano. The more you play basketball, the more you play the piano, the better you get. The more you mentor and disciple people, the better you get. And it's really a two-way street. As you're helping that younger person, it begins to be a blessing and help to you as well. Do you have a handful of godly peers in your life? If not, we each need a handful of godly people about our age, level of maturity. They can minister to us. We can minister to them. It's mutually beneficial. For mentoring and discipleship, joining a small group is a great place to start. Our church can offer you such an opportunity for about a number of small groups. Now, I want you to know that my wife and I run the risk of letting people get close to us. What risk is it? Here it is. If I stay behind this pulpit and preach to you, it's easier to look good at a distance. But if I let you get close to me and we start spending time away from the pulpit, outside of church, now you can get close and you see my warts and blemishes. And you see that I'm not perfect and that Sue and I don't have a perfect marriage. You need to see that because you're never going to be perfect either. One day I brought a moody girl home with me. She wanted to spend some time with Sue. The very moment she had that moody girl and I walked into our living room, we were met by our then 18-year-old son, Jeffrey, in the middle of throwing a hot, hissy fit. He was spewing his displeasure everywhere. And at first I thought, oh, this is terrible. What's this girl going to think about our home life? What kind of home do we have? What kind of kids do we have? And then I thought, wait a minute, this is good. She needs to see that our kids don't wear halos, because when she has children, they're not going to wear halos either. So it'll be good for this young woman to see how Sue and I handle an 18-year-old in the middle of a hot, hissy fit. So we run the risk of letting people get close to us. And I think one reason that Christians keep others at arm's length is, I don't have it together. And I don't want you to see my struggles and see my shortcomings. Folks, people need to see your struggles. They have a lot of respect for you. They hold you in high esteem. They may think you're perfect. They need to know that you're not. They're never going to be perfect. And when they see your flaws and that yet you still walk with God and God use you, that can encourage them. So what did Jesus say? Go and convert people. Go and make disciples by helping them be converted and by teaching them to be obedient. Folks, this church needs to be about the business of discipling people. There are people in this church that need to be discipled. They need an older male, older female in their life. There are people in this church that can be the disciplers, the mentors, men and women. And I want you to consider now, if you need a mentor, ask us about that. I want you to consider being that older person in somebody's life. So, Lord Jesus, we do want to be obedient to you. You have put the Great Commission not only on the shoulders of those disciples way back then, but on us. You want to use us to be a blessing to people, to mentor them. Would you assist in that? Help us to be willing, Lord, to be mentored or to be mentors to others. In Jesus' name, amen.